From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is an opportunity for commentary and analysis and perhaps even some insight into the news media issues of the week. And we'll see if we can deliver all of that for you. My name is Rex Smith. I'm the editor of the Times Union here, as I have been every week for the last 25 years or so, with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Thank you, Alan, for having us into your studios.
Okay,
over there. And we're greeted by more cheerily Professor Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose. How do you do?
I do well.
Well, good.
I am cheery. It's another day to do more work.
Oh, boy. And Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette, now with the New York Press Association. You okay?
I'm happy to be here as well. There are so many interesting media issues to discuss.
There are, and we have such a little bit of time to do it. By the way, it's just really great to have you two here, because Alan and I were here last week with Ira Fussfeld, whom we love, of course. It's great to be here, but three old white guys sitting in a room, you know, is not quite as appropriate.
Did you pass the state budget?
And we promised we'd try to do that.
Did
you pass the state budget? Three men in a room?
Yeah.
And that's over now. Andrea Stewart Cousins.
Changed that
formula.
We had complaints, by the way, about our coverage of that, because we put the photograph of Andrea Stewart Cousins in the middle of the front page of the Times Union with a headline, because we thought it a rather historic glass ceiling being broken. First woman in the room. And that drew complaints, notably from a local talk radio station, saying that we're just catering to minority readers, since there's so many around here, that actually it's no difference. It's just another Democrat in the room. So it was just the Times Union's bias showing through.
And as if that guy who runs that right-wing radio station didn't know any better. He doesn't narrow cast to a group, does he?
Yeah, right. No narrow casting there.
Well, that individual's missing the point. I mean, this is historic, and to have another and different voice and a person of color in that position is extraordinarily important. So it's newsworthy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, speaking of newsworthiness, a couple of questions about the national media here, how we think they've been doing on two topics. One has to do with the fire coverage of California. You know, we've heard about the fire coverage, but the allegation that is raised by some analysts is that the East Coast bias of the major media, the electronic media especially, is leading to not enough fire coverage. This is written by someone who lives in Oakland, where the air quality has been so bad lately, of course. But the fact is that when you compare the coverage that hurricanes get, she says, with that of the wildfires of California earlier this month and last month, there is so much less going on. What do you think about that?
I think that it's specious to be criticizing the media on the East Coast for coverage of the West Coast, because there has been coverage. I'm an East Coaster. I read the East Coast media, and I'm pretty familiar with what's happening in the fires. So I think the East Coast media is doing a fine job in covering the fires in California. Clearly, when you have media outlets in particular regions, they are going to give better and more intensive coverage. This writer that wrote about this, though, is a freelancer. So rather than complaining, why is she not covering that fire?
You know, I thought the media did a great job of covering this fire early, especially early on, because it seemed like it was an astounding event that was happening. This fire was ripping through these areas. But, I mean, I have been a little discouraged in the last week or so, because at one point there were 600 or 700 people missing. And then yesterday I realized how many people actually died. And you can find that kind of information if you look for it. But we in the media know that it's hard to sustain coverage day after day after day of a big event. Hurricanes, you can do it. But I think there are lots of follow-ups to do. I, for one, still want to know how many people died in that fire.
Now I had to step out to take an important phone call from our
Well, we'll catch you up.
For a group, I know, but I wanted to say, I think the letter writer has a very good point. I mean, I think that we are East Coast centric, the media is, and that, you know, this is a horrific series of events. But then again, what can you say after you play it day after day after day and show the fire? What's new?
Well, I'll tell you what she suggests. She says CNN could invite on climate scientists and meteorologists to discuss not only the scope and devastation and causes of the fire, but California's increasingly bleak future of wildfires. Bring on experts on California politics to talk about the corporate malfeasance of the state utility company, which is found liable for most of the October 2017 fires last year. She says that there is that kind of stuff, more on the background of it, what led to the fires. You know, the interesting thing is hurricanes, it does seem to me that it is more immediate coverage. It's almost like a hurricane. We know that is a storm that will pass. I think one of the reasons that it's hard for television, especially, to cover fires is that it's not exciting and you don't know that it's going to end. Hurricanes are forces that are devastating, but you see them and then they are gone and the sun comes out and you can cover that. Fires are just devastating and horrible, and so it's really a downer. And I do think that the television coverage is less intense, I think, is her point, than what it would be if a similar number of people, 70 people killed by a hurricane.
Now, wait a second. Now, just wait a second, Mr. Rex.
Mm-hmm.
What if we had a devastating series of fires on the East Coast?
Right.
Do you think that the coverage would be a differential?
I'm agreeing with the writer here, saying I think that they should have done a better job, and I think it would be, in fact, yeah, sure. If there were 80 people killed in a fire in the East, thousands of homes destroyed, the deadliest U.S. fire in history, I think it would be easier to cover because the networks are headquartered here.
Also, it's really unusual.
Right,
and they have fires frequently in California. If there was a big fire on the East Coast, that would be start off with being highly unusual, so it would be different, so it would be news.
Well, when the Twin Towers were crashed into by the planes, how many people died? Do you guys remember?
Day it was about 1,800, right?
Yeah,
between
about 2,000 people,
yeah,
right?
Including, yeah.
So that's what's happened out in California, and we're still hearing about, you know, what happened here in New York City. Look, the major bureaus, let's face it, NPR, it's true with NPR too, although they have something out there. You know, the major bureaus are in Washington and New York City, right? Ease of coverage is. I once read a book by Professor Delmer C. Dunn. Don't you remember him?
I'm so excited to learn about him.
I can't imagine. It's,
I think, the best book that's ever been written about journalism. But anyway, he went around and he asked everybody, you know, what were the criteria for covering stories? And it was a confidential questionnaire. And one of the things that was said is, Ease of coverage. How easy is it to get to that?
That's a preposterous. What?
Is he a real person?
I don't
believe that.
Are you
back to your EOR ways?
What was the copyright date on that book?
Of course, the book's been out of print for a long time.
Yeah, indeed. And there probably are no requests for more. But
I requested it.
Oh, you did.
He said, no, it's too hard.
Oh, it was all that. Was that you teeing us up just for that very thing?
Ah.
So it's not even real, what you just said.
No,
it's real.
It's a real thing.
So there are different degrees of coverage, right? Like, there are lazy reporters and there are hardworking reporters.
Oh, come on. Will you people stop that nonsense? You all know, as I do, that if a reporter has an easier time of getting to a story and has to do a story every day or two stories every day, that's going to be part of the equation.
True. I mean, for one thing, there are editors who encourage reporters to go into difficult assignments.
They kick their behinds.
And there are some reporters who really look forward to really deep digging into stories that are difficult. There is a matter of newsworthiness based upon proximity. You know, what is local is, in fact, more newsworthy for local media outlets. So that might be what Professor Dunn was trying to talk about.
Ease of coverage.
Not ease of coverage, proximity being a matter that makes it more newsworthy.
You know, and a reporter can take an easy approach and do a story, but if the editor won't put it in the newspaper, it's all for naught. I mean, there are a lot of easy stories out there, but at the end of the day, the reporter has to get it on a page or on the website, and if the editor says, oh no, there's no story here, then that's not going to happen. And you do too many of those easy stories and you're out the door.
Right.
Yeah, and it is interesting that different reporters respond to that differently. Now, I say that because we here at WAMC, you know, have a vast number of reporters out there. And sometimes I can pretty well predict what we're going to get from each of them, which of them are going to do the hard stuff and which of them are going to do the easy stuff. Now, Judy, you know that's the case, don't you?
There are easy stories out there. It's true. The press releases that come in the door, you make a call, you file it in. But that was 10 or 15 years ago. I think nowadays it's harder.
There's I don't know.
Fewer people on staff, less room to put it in the paper. And I think reporters are making harder choices, and they're having to work harder to stand out.
You guys are such a bunch of foo-foos. You really are.
We're just
You're
realists.
Always defending the indefensible. But here's the thing of it that I really do believe. Rex has a story, I think, on the front page of his paper today. Maybe it was the Berkshire Eagle. Don't I read a lot of papers. About this lady, and I read them in the middle of the night. This lady who had two pugs, two beautiful little doggies, and they got through the fence, and she hasn't been able to find these pugs.
I don't believe that was my paper. Okay.
No, they had the limo crash on today's front page and some really good DMV information.
Some really good investigative reporting by Larry Rulison.
Really hard work.
Sleeves
up. It wasn't of interest to Alan because he doesn't live here. So,
there you
know.
Go, patting each other.
But it's in the Berkshires that pugs make the front page. I mean, that's an important story, too. Your dog is an important story.
The front page can be what's important or what's interesting.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you put a little bit of something that's interesting. I mean, far be it from WAMC to have content that's interesting. Let's just have important stuff here, you know.
Well, I think that is one of our problems, to tell you the truth, if you want me to be self-critical. You
yes,
know,
we do. Go ahead.
Please. I defer.
We do the intellectually heavy stuff as opposed to the stuff that sometimes I think might attract or interest some of our listeners. So how's that?
Well,
it's
that's
good.
That's interesting. I think there's, I suppose we all could plead guilty to that, there being content that is boring in our pages, that doesn't have relevance. People don't understand the relevance. It is usually our failure to explain to people adequately in our reporting why something is relevant.
Well, let's just dive into that for a second. You know, you say boring, and I agree. Boring is bad. Now, take the ash trees.
Like
Emerald ash borer.
That's the one.
Our job is to make the boring interesting, and if we don't do that, we failed.
Well, if all your ash trees are going to die because the borer, you know, is boring into them.
If you have thoughts, media@wamc.org is how you intersect with us. That's Alan Chartok of Northeast Public Radio. And Judy Patrick and Kaylin Brown and Rex Smith were here. I said the other story that we were going to have to take a look at is migrant story, the story from the border, whether there is adequate coverage now. You know, the difficulty is that during the run-up to the election, when the president was talking so much about the caravan coming, it seemed as though there was a lot of mimicking of his words. Now, the question is, what has happened to the substantive coverage of the immigration issue? Or are we just catering to the president's characterization of this as a story?
You know, I'm seeing some pretty good coverage of it, although maybe it just reflects where I'm going and what I'm looking for. You know, the other thing that I was thinking about is when the early days of this caravan, you saw a lot of reporters from the U.S. go down and talk to people in the caravan. And it almost seems like they weren't giving them information. And I recognize that it's not the reporter's role to give the information. But the people in the caravan were naive about what was happening, what was going to happen when they got to the border. And you have to wonder, did journalism do them a disservice by not explaining more carefully about what was going to happen when they got to that border? Because they're going to sit there, the people who made it to the border are going to sit there for 3 or 4 months for an asylum hearing, and they're going to be rejected their asylum. It's all for naught. But I don't think the reporters should have taken the role of trying to discourage them, but just give them the information about the reality of what was going to happen.
Well, they were embedded, of course, with them. My fear here is that sometimes when we do coverage, we don't really get it. So, for example, the best thing that has happened to Donald Trump in the last 2 weeks since we've all met is the idea that a group of these of the migrants rushed to the border. And that gave him a chance to say, see, this is what I've been talking about all along. These are rogues. They're terrible people. They're trying to get into the country. Now, okay, that's fair enough. But then you ask yourself, well, why did that happen? I mean, was it just by accident that a bunch of people rushed the border? Or was there a greater purpose? Did somebody spread the word, we're going to do this today? And who could have been behind it?
It would be great. You really hope to have reporting who could find that out, but you'd have to be embedded with those people in that camp to be able to do that, I would think.
And that's why I go back to what I said before, Kaylin, ease of coverage. You know, I mean, it would be great to have a reporter like that, but that's what you guys as editors, all three of you, have expected of your people, right?
Well, there are reporters embedded, and the reporting is happening. I'm reading stories about what's happening with the migrants at the border. I think all of us are. So the coverage is happening. Can there be more? There can always be more, but we need our listeners to be willing to pay for their news so that we can have more resources at our news outlets, especially newspapers who do more of the deep dig.
There you go. Okay, I have a personal complaint here, and it comes from a piece of email that I got last night as we sit here. His return address is EOPWHO, which apparently stands for Executive Office of the President, White House Operations or something. Weston W. Lloyd, who is the Director of Regional Communications for the White House, sent an email to me, and I don't know what the propriety of this is, but this email is labeled on background. Now, I don't know Weston Lloyd. I've never asked him for information. I've never communicated with the Trump White House, to my knowledge, and I never agree to take anything on background from them. Anyway, I don't even know what that means in this instance, because it's three sentences on background that says, and I'm going to read it for you here. I wonder if this violates his rule that he's imposed. The president, joined by Secretary Chao and Ambassador Lighthizer, had a private lunch today with Governor Cuomo at the White House. The group discussed a number of important topics focusing on infrastructure. The president cares deeply for his home state of New York and always appreciates the opportunity to engage with the governor on issues important to the state and region, period. So what I don't understand is what the rules are. If somebody says on the phone to me, look, I want to talk to you off the record. I have sometimes said, no, I don't want to talk to you off the record. What you say is on the record here. An agreement has to be both ways. What do you suppose Weston Lloyd meant by on background, and why would he have sent me an email that says gobbledygook on background? I don't understand what's going on.
Well, there are 1,000 possibilities here, right? I mean, one of them is that the governor is not adored in upstate New York. Am I wrong about that? I mean, you know, the voting and the rest of it, Schenectady, your old paper area, voted against them. And most of upstate New York did also. So would it be impossible to think that even the White House may have been behind this, or maybe even the Cuomo people would have benefited from a story like this one?
From
a story which we could keep on background, but
I mean, everybody knows that the governor went down to Washington to have lunch with the president.
This is a guy who ran his entire campaign against Trump.
Yeah.
That's all he talked about was Trump.
What I'm saying is it was public information announced in advance that the governor and the president were going to sit down together. There was conversation about it. The governor had a press conference afterwards to talk about it. I just don't understand.
It's a waste of time.
This is a waste of effort to send this on background. Yeah.
It's a non sequitur. Yeah. There's no context. It's incoherent, and it doesn't serve a purpose.
The director of regional communications for the White House doesn't know how the rules work. How much does he get paid? What experience does he have? What kind of public service is he doing? Because he clearly doesn't know what he's doing.
Or is he just trying to say, Mr. Newspaper Editor, I'm sending you something, and I'm going to try to fool you into thinking it's valuable information.
Editors are stupid.
Well, that's not all wrong, except in Rex's case.
Oh, there we go.
So he may be saying, let's keep it on background. By the way, when you talk to Governor Cuomo, as I have in the past, inevitably, if it's a conversation in which he calls you, and one day he called me, he was being very nice about my having written a good column about him, which surprised him. His first words are inevitably, let's keep this between ourselves so that, you know, we'll talk and you're not allowed to use this.
And what do you say? Okay. Okay. If you say okay, then that's how it's supposed to go.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the classroom, we tell reporters off the record means you cannot use the information you receive. You cannot confirm that information. You must go to your grave with that information. So there's no point in telling a reporter off the record. You can try. Background information means that you agree as a journalist to protect the identity of the individual, but making sure that they understand that background means I intend to check this with other sources to verify it, make sure it's accurate, and attribute it to a reliable source. You know, there's a distinction.
You know, it's so interesting you say that because, of course, you're right about everything you've just said. Nevertheless, I think I see a change in the rules on the part of the press. I heard something the other day on one of the channels in which they said, well, you know, this was an off-the-record conversation. They said what it involved, and then he said it was an off-the-record conversation, so we can't tell you who said it. But what you said was correct, Caitlin, which was, if they've given you information and it's off the record, you can't use any of it.
I think people are pretty sloppy about their definitions of what things mean, and this is why you have to really have a conversation with someone about what they mean by off the record or what they mean by on background. And we encourage our people to always see if you can go back to that individual who wants to be off the record and say, look, here's what you said to me. Can't we put this on the record? Let's see if we can do this. And we even have instances where people will say, well, I will not be a named source for you, but if you are sued, I will step forward rather than you have to go to jail to protect my identity.
Have you guys all heard of the 7-second rule? The 7-second rule is your kid drums something on the floor.
5 seconds. 5 seconds. Yeah, and this is connected how?
Because I know people who say, you know, well, something that happened 10 years ago, which may have been an off-the-record conversation, is no longer off the record.
Huh. I've not heard that. You know, Deep Throat being the great case of that. We didn't know Deep Throat's identity as Mark Felt until about 10 years ago. And it wasn't until he actually stepped forward, perhaps in his senility, to say, yes, I am that guy, that Bob Woodward, I think, finally confirmed. But
how does that relate to the 7-second rule?
Well, it was 25 years. He never would have told us who Deep Throat was had the source himself not come forward.
Well, right.
And students ask about that all the time. I had a source who was giving me information during an interview, but they said off the record. And my first question is, did they tell you the information and then say off the record? Or did they ask for an off of the record conversation and then give you the information?
Sure.
Because if a source gives a reporter information and then says off the record, that information is fair game. Mm. There are ethical questions about whether to use it or not, but it's still fair game.
Okay, before we go, another ethical question. If you're a broadcast interviewer, would you share with someone in advance what you're going to ask them before you go in front of the camera? This apparently is something that Fox and Friends does when they have administration officials. When they had Scott Pruitt on, when he was the EPA administrator, apparently somebody, the guest host, failed to do that, and he was...
And do what exactly again?
Let him know what you're going to ask. Here's what we're going to talk about, you know, and basically even wait for the principal to actually tell you, here's what we want to talk about. What do you think about that?
Is that so terrible?
Depends on what kind of a conversation, depends on who you're having, I think.
Well,
you know, are you...
You want to prime them for information, and you say to them, okay, I'm going to ask you about thus and so, because get ready. I don't see what's so terrible about that.
Well, it's okay to say we want to interview you about climate change, but is it proper to give them the exact questions ahead of time? No.
Right. And if you're talking to somebody who is a high-level official, a newsmaker, you're trying to get information from them, I think that giving them an advanced sense of what the interview is going to be about, it is a question of integrity. Now, we have a very intense technical story. We have shared it then with the scientists who are involved, say, to say, did we get this right? Not that they can edit it, but the goal is to make sure that things are right. Well, we're going to have more conversation about this another time because we're running out of time, and our producer, Dave Gustina, steps into the studio to basically say, get out, get out. There's work to be done in this place. What do you think?
Get out.
Okay. Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Men are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. And Judy Patrick is the Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
They claim to represent the common people.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast the Media Project anytime.